Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hello, this is Matt Shaw for the Tolkien Professor and my fellow Silmarillionaires. This is episode 14, Knock Knock, Morgoth, and covers chapter 13 of The Return of the Noldor. In this episode, Fëanor courts death and is rewarded by Gothmog, but not before dooming the Noldor in general, and his family in particular, to ages of tragedy and torment. However, it should be noted that the rare successful party is pulled off. In this session, we explore the sometimes subtle distinctions between craft and sub-creation, revisit Fingolfin's awesomeness, and note the introduction of Dragon 1.0 in the form of Glauron. This episode is packed, so let's get to it.
Okay, good evening. Let's see, Laura, let's actually address your last question first here, because I think that is a perfectly legitimate observation.
Yeah, just reading this chapter, it seems like, you know, we're just going at a breakneck pace through all these events, any one of which could be an entire chapter, and some of which could be an entire book. And I think that's where a lot of people have problems with the Silmarillion, because it's everything is just so packed in and just going at such breakneck speed. So that's what really struck me when reading this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, and I agree with you. This chapter does strike me more in that way than most of the chapters that we've read. Certainly, I mean, you think about just like a brief list of only the more significant things that happen in this chapter. I mean, you get the death of Fëanor, you get the arrival of Fingolfin and the troops, and the sort of, you know, the standoff around the lake. You get the capture of Maedhros and his rescue by Fingon, which is such a really big and far-reaching story in Tolkien's whole work. You get two great battles. You get the founding of Nargothrond and Gondolin. It just keeps going and going. It was actually, as I was rereading this chapter, especially as I was listening to it, this morning, I kept sort of forgetting where it ended I kept expecting it to end and then it never did. Right. And as Mike points out, dragons too.
Yeah, Glauron shows up too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. So yeah, there's certainly plenty to talk about tonight. I want to try to be sort of as orderly as possible under the circumstances and see if we can hit on a bunch of these major things, not necessarily in order, but let's see if we can kind of keep some of these things straight. And focus our questions on this. So, let's see. Let me start with let's start with the death of Fëanor, because the death of Fëanor we've kind of alluded to several times. I think it must have been three different weeks previously in which I have almost talked about the death of Fëanor and then said, no, we should wait until we get there. So let's finally talk about that. Let's see, a couple of you wanted to talk about, let's see, John, I think you were wanting to talk about, Fëanor's death in connection with his pride, which is certainly something we've talked about before. So let's definitely think about that. Do you want to say something about that, John?
Yes. Well, going over the chapter, I was reminded of an email I got from someone writing their thesis for MythCon talking about the sin of pride, which I felt was quite ingenious. And where I was coming from is, at the beginning of the chapter, it seems like quite a climactic beginning in its sense. We get the feel that Fëanor is rushing headlong to his death. He is basically not being cautious. Morgoth basically is underestimating the elves. And it seems like here, at this one junction, this one point in elven history, we see one of basically the highest and most ruthless leaders of basically the Noldor, the sons of Fëanor, succumbing solely to the will of basically the magnanimous will of their father here, who is basically absorbed solely in his one objection, basically to overthrow the Dark Lord of Angband. So, in a sense, what we now feel here is Fëanor succumbing solely to his one drive and his one purpose. He isn't stopping. We don't hear him, like, hearkening to any advice at all. And as you were pointing out earlier, the feel of this chapter feels definitely accelerated. I could easily see the death of Fëanor in some, you know, early Lay of Beleriand being, you know, taken up by several lines in some kind of early, you know, ballad or something like that. It seems almost as well to point to Fëanor's, you know, infamous skill in battle later on, his courage, and yet we also see his most negative side. This is, I think, the apex of his true character. On one hand, we see, okay, well, he is, in the end, trying to accomplish his goals, and he's doing so in quite a reckless manner. And yet, on the other end of the, you know, the spectrum of his character here, we see him driven towards what seems to be a frontal assault, which appears to ignite the rest of the, you know, the Sindar into the fight. I mean, you know, we kind of get the sense that the war truly begins to have a different approach, a more offensive approach, as soon as Feanor reaches into the scene. I mean, his entire tactics are completely aggressive, and the root of this aggressiveness, I feel, is basically his pride, his anger, his hate. I believe there's a song by Blind Guardian, a famous Tolkien band in the album Nightfall of Middle-earth, The Curse of Feanor, which actually deals with this.
Yes, and that's actually my favorite song on that album, by the way. The Curse of Feanor.
The Curse of Feanor. I love that. I mean, I recently bought it and I was listening to it. I just really enjoyed it. And when I was hearing it, first of all, I was imagining, oh boy, wouldn't it be great to have one of those almost like radio drama snippets right beforehand of the death of Feanor? And second, what I was really trying to picture, especially, and I know it's sort of related and unrelated to the topic I originally addressed, was his duel with the Balrogs. And the first thing, I don't know if it's mentioned or not, but Goth Mog has to be fighting Feanor. I mean, you know, who else among all the Balrogs? So what we see is a Maia spirit fighting hand-to-hand, probably, with the greatest of the elves. And, I mean, what we understand about Feanor at this point in time is that of all the Noldor, he is basically gifted with basically the greatest skills and yet the greatest, you know, harms born of his own intuition. And his own intuition here is bent directly and solely on basically hacking, destroying, usurping slayers and destroyers, you know, as Treebeard points out, I think in the film version of The Two Towers, I think it's in The Fellowship of the Ring and the Tom Bombadil, you know, chapter, how this malignant force here, this is Feanor marred at his best, or his worst, really. And
yeah.
I felt like, you know, it definitely should be addressed in greater detail.
No, definitely. So I mean, I really agree. I mean, I think that the Feanor stuff here, this is a moment, I think, which is kind of, well, for me, this is always the encapsulation of Feanor gone bad. You know, everything that we see, everything that we've talked about with Feanor before, his incredible gifts, his incredible power, his pride, his determination, his going his own way, you know, him being off. I mean, that metaphor of him driving the hordes the remnants of the hordes of Morgoth before him, but sprinting out in front of everybody else. You know, he's on his own. He's head and shoulders, you know, he's beyond everybody else. You know, he's lengths and lengths in front of everybody else. And he is, but he doesn't care. And he's going his own, he's doing his own thing and sticking his neck out. And ultimately his power and his pride are his downfall and bring him into a trap of his own making. And Melkor ensnares him, essentially. That is, at least the Balrogs come out and catch him. But even then, it's not even exactly that he is destroyed by the Balrogs. I mean, he's stricken down by Gothmog. But even then, his final death is, I think, sort of the most essentially that even itself. The passing of his spirit and the collapsing of his body into dust, the passing of his fiery spirit, this sort of the self-destructiveness in the end of the fiery spirit of Feanor, you know, whose name, remember, means spirit of fire. This image for me is always, basically like Feanor in this Feanor in one image, Feanor in a nutshell. Of course, as Laura points out, everything is in a nutshell in this chapter. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, Brandon, I was just about to say the same thing. You want to go ahead and talk about the death of Feanor and that connection you just mentioned in the chat?
Yeah, it seems to me that there are only two examples in the whole canon of people turning into ash, and one is Feanor. You know, what is the kind of parallel there? It seems to be like maybe an unhealthy, you know, quest for knowledge and pride and maybe even, you know, Sin and they both have great falls, you know. I don't know if there's a connection there with using the fire to a certain end, not enough to the sub-creation, you know. If you could comment on that, Corey.
Yeah, no, I really think so. I mean, we're talking about the parallel between Feanor and Saruman here. And the two things are quite striking. It's actually funny. I wasn't even thinking of the disintegration of the bodies, though of course we do get that. Now what we get described in Saruman is a kind of like accelerated collapse and decomposition. We don't get that sort of, you know, boom, you know, the thing just collapsing into dust as the fiery spirit you know, destroys it. It's more it seems to be more of an accelerated corruption or rotting. But I agree. I mean, we do get, can't think of any other places where we get that happening, you know, where someone dies and this sort of spectacular thing spontaneously happens to their bodies. But in addition, the thing which actually suggested that exact same parallel to me that is between Feanor's death and Saruman's death is the smoke. That is, so fiery was his spirit that it sped, that as it sped, his body fell to ash and was borne away like smoke. And you'll remember when Saruman dies, you know, sort of the cloud of his spirit rises up and turns towards the west as if in appeal or supplication, but a wind comes from the west and blows it away. So I think that I think is really interesting, especially what we get immediately after the smoke reference. With Feanor too. So with Saruman, what we see there is sort of this glimpse of the spiritual drama behind the scenes. His body has perished, but we know, of course, that Saruman is one of the Istari. He is a Maia like Gandalf, who has come to Middle Earth and been incarnated in order to help people. His spirit is in its death, apparently turning to the west and seeking to return to Valinor, which is where he came from. But then he is rejected, apparently, and that seems to be the significance of the wind that blows out of the west and blows him away. He has betrayed the west, and there can be no returning for the spirit of Saruman. Now, Feanor, when he falls into ash, and his and the ash is borne away like smoke, we're not told like where the wind is coming from. We don't get the whole like a wind from the west came. It's nothing quite that clear. But what he immediately segues to is, and his likeness has never again appeared in Arda, neither has his spirit left the halls of Mandos. In other words, there's a kind of banishment there too. We know that elves can eventually receive a new body. They can sort of make a new body for their spirit once their spirits are finished being cleansed, have finished their time of awaiting in the halls of Mandos. Feanor is not getting out of the halls of Mandos, and his likeness has never again appeared in Arda. That might sound like, and there has never been anybody like him again in Arda, but I don't think that's true. I don't think that that's what that means. His likeness has never appeared again. Meaning, I think, his body, his person, he's not coming back. Feanor is gone, and isn't going to return. Now, it's not that his spirit has been annihilated. We know that his spirit is in the halls of Mandos and has never left. But that sentence, the end of that sentence, that smells like a prison sentence to me, or to an actual banishment. And there is a sense of an actual purgatorial nature to the halls of Mandos. Some of the places where Tolkien talks about it, it does sound that the souls in Mandos are sometimes actually being purged of the crimes that they committed during the span of the life of their bodies. And I don't know if, you know, Feanor has just got a long road ahead of him there on the purgatorial process or what, or whether he's actually being imprisoned or what. But yeah, I mean, I think that seems to be implied. So that's another thing that I was then thinking about. Again, we don't get that, the direct connection, the sort of wind from the west rejecting Feanor, but we do get the, you know, what sounds like a prison sentence immediately after that. So I think those two are really interestingly connected. Mike, go ahead.
Very much like the when we do these comparisons between the Silmarillion and the other works of Tolkien, I was thinking of one comparison between the Silmarillion and The Hobbit, and I was thinking about the death of Feanor as compared to the death of Thorin Oakenshield in The Hobbit, and I was thinking about, okay, here were two mortally wounded, sort of obsessed characters, and to sort of talk about it in gambling terms, Thorin, at the end, sort of walks away from the table and walks away from the game and says, this is a game you can't win, and repents and ends up saying, I'm now going to go to the halls of my fathers. Whereas Feanor doubles down. he pushes it to the very end. There is no repentance. I mean, it's to the very end. He's just completely obsessed. And I think that ties in with the point you just made about how he's not headed for the halls of his fathers. He's headed for some sort of purgatory. But I was just thinking of those two characters at their ends.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good comparison, too. It's certainly one that really, by contrast, I do think really emphasizes the important thing that we can see here. I mean, we can see this even before he's stricken down. You know, one of my favorite sentences from the first of our two paragraphs on the death of Feanor when he's chasing after the orcs, seeking, you know, hoping that he can find Morgoth himself. Nothing did he know of Angband or the great strength of defense that Morgoth had so swiftly prepared. But even had he known it would not have deterred him, for he was fey, consumed by the flame of his own wrath. And we can see, I think, that same sort of impulse. He had no idea when he's trying. I mean, he seems to be assuming that, you know, he's catching Morgoth on the hop, and he's gonna follow these orcs back, and Morgoth's gonna be what, like sitting in an open camp? He's thinking. And he has no idea that what he's charging towards is this almost impregnable fortress. But then there's that wonderful moment, and if he had known, he wouldn't have cared. He still would have charged single-handedly against the nearly impregnable fortress. And you can see that same kind of just toweringly arrogant stubbornness at the end there on his deathbed. And as you say, Mike, exactly contrary to Thorin Oakenshield, death, or the prospect of imminent death, gives Thorin clearly a new perspective. As he Thorin explicitly says there, you know, since he is now going to a place that is in death, where he can't bring his treasure with him and the treasure isn't going to do him any good, he can now distance himself from that, and he can now see what's really important, and he can see things from a different perspective. You might think that Feanor would have a similar moment. Now that I'm going to perish, now that I'm going, you know, to the halls of Mandos, you know, now I can see, you know, wow, really, I've done a lot of really bad things, and this is all really not working out. But no, as you say, he doubles down. He knew with the foreknowledge of death that no power of the Noldor would ever overthrow them. So this is not just like, I see that I'm not going to be able to achieve anything because I'm going to die. I know for sure that nobody, that this whole expedition that I have led is 100% guaranteed to be fruitless. And yet, he's still not going to turn away. He's still not going to change his perspective. But he cursed the name of Morgoth thrice and laid it upon his sons to hold to their oath and to avenge their father. I mean, those two things juxtaposed like that are almost unbelievable. With the foreknowledge of death, he knows for a fact nobody can possibly conquer Morgoth. So what do you do as a consequence of that? Make your sons swear that they'll keep battering themselves against this absolutely impossible task for the rest of their lives. Great job, Dad. That's fantastic. So no, I mean, it really is. You can see Feanor going out, Mike, as you say, completely unrepentant. It's really, really pretty unbelievable, I think. Any other thoughts on Feanor's death here before we move on to one of our other 15 topics to discuss in this chapter? Okay. Jordan, you wanted to talk about feasts?
Yeah, I just want to point out that when Fingolfin throws a feast, nothing goes wrong for the only time in the history of the book.
I should have known that this was going to be a Fingolfin-centered topic, though it didn't seem like it at first. Yes, you're right. And I do think that is kind of interesting, that this moment is just about the only peaceful celebration we're going to see. Yes, they all get together and they throw a big party and they have a big celebration and no calamity occurs. This now makes us one for two on the big celebrations. Of course, the Darkening of Valinor happened during this great time of festival, and we will see several times of festival go tragically awry later on. Yes, Jordan, it is true. On Fingolfin's watch, festivals happen peacefully. But and that moment, I think, is one certainly in the middle of the more tumultuous events of this chapter. That feast, I think, might be kind of overlookable, or it might be easy to kind of glance past it. But I do think that that's a really important moment, because we can see the way that everyone, not only that everyone is coming together. This is sort of the final. The final affirmation of the reunion of the Noldor, and the forgiveness of Fingolfin and his people of the sons of Fëanor. But also the way that, you know, you get Círdan coming up, you get the couple of people coming out from Doriath, which is also sort of a very good indication of sort of where things are going and where things are. We can see the tension there already, even though Thingol doesn't yet have any idea that the kinslaying has happened. But yes, Merodh Adarthad, the Feast of Reuniting, is, I think, a really crucial thing. We can see here the reuniting of the elves. This is like the establishment of Beleriand now. I think, you know, this is really the moment where we can say, okay, the elven kingdoms in Beleriand are now established. And in some sense, this is the apex. You know, once Gondolin and Nargothrond are formed, it's never going to get any better than this. This is the high point in the history of Beleriand, and it is all a long downhill stretch from here. That's therefore, I think, an interesting thing to notice. Let's pause for a second to talk. There have been a couple sort of smaller vocabulary and terminology questions. Let's touch on those before we get to some of the other bigger events. Matt, you had a question about craft?
Yeah, the way that the word craft is used, it seems to have a lot of weight and significance. It kind of reminds me of Tolkien's bliss and grace. In the sense that they seem to mean much more than they do on the surface. You get the idea that craft doesn't just mean extreme skill in making things. It goes way beyond that.
Yeah. Can you give an example of where you're thinking of where it's used?
Yes. Well, it's on page 113 in my edition, in the paragraph at the top. And these were learning their craft skills from the elves. And I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Caranthir,
yeah. Caranthir, yes. And we have the unlovely.
Of course, it also has that lovely ironic. Yes, I was going to mention another diss by the elves on the dwarves.
Yeah. Caranthir, I think he's not the most, in the end, he's not the most harmful. But he's the biggest jerk of the Sons of Fëanor. There's really no questions about that. So let's read that sentence.
And that's saying something.
Yeah, exactly. That's a tough crowd. So we talk about Caranthir. Caranthir was haughty and scarce concealed his scorn for the unloveliness of the Naugrim, and his people followed their lord. Nevertheless, since both peoples feared and hated Morgoth, they made alliance, and had of it great profit, for the Naugrim learned many secrets of craft in those days, so that the smiths and masons of Nogrod and Belagost became renowned among their kin, and when the dwarves began again to journey into Beleriand, all the traffic of the dwarf mines passed first through the hands of Caranthir, and thus great riches came to him. Secrets of craft, yeah. It's we're talking about craftsmanship, and but I agree with you, it's a word that's being used in a broad kind of way. There's a sort of a very general, I don't know, like stuff related to Aule sense of the word here, you know, that the secrets of craft that they learned, and the generality with which the word craft is being used here. One thing that I think is really kind of interesting here, we get references to the craftsmanship of the dwarves, but I think it's kind of interesting that they don't seem to be sort of, I mean, they're makers. I'm pausing because I'm trying to make sure that what I'm going to say is quite fair, but there doesn't seem to be quite as much emphasis on the dwarves as sub-creators as there is on the elves, that they make great works. But for instance, here, thinking since we're on the subject of dwarven craftsmanship, Thinking of the Nauglamir, yet another major thing just kind of tossed off in the middle of this chapter in one paragraph or a few sentences. The Nauglamir, the necklace of the dwarves, that was made for Finrod. Thinking of the relationship between the elven, or the sort of comparison and contrast between elven craft and dwarvish craft, Finrod has brought with him all of these gems from Valinor. He brought more gems with him than anybody else. And we read about the gems of the Noldor, how gems were the big innovation of the Noldor. Even Aule hadn't thought of gems and gem cutting. And the Noldor were producing these gems and making these gems, and of course the Silmarils were just the greatest example of these. Now, here's Finrod with a whole pile of Valinorian gems, those Noldorin gems, and he brings them to the dwarves, and the dwarves make what we're told, this is the highest piece of craftsmanship, this is dwarven craft at its highest point. This is like the Silmarils for the dwarves. But what it is they're taking these Noldorin gems and they're forming them into a necklace. Now, I mean, the necklace is clearly itself magical, and it is clearly, you know, it is a wondrous thing. But when you compare the Nauglafring as a work of craft to the gems themselves as works of craft, as the Noldor's work of craft, or sort of to the Silmarils, I think you can see some parallels. But at the same time, I think that there's a really interesting difference there. Brandon, what do you think?
I thought that Sauron, if I'm not mistaken, reached the elves because he taught them craftsmanship, and in fact, that's how the Nine Rings were created. The person who created them was sort of an apprentice of someone, maybe someone who was an apprentice of Sauron.
Yeah. Sauron is he does make the Nine Rings, though he is working with them. So, I mean, this is sort of looking forward to, we'll get some discussion of this, of course, at the very end, in our very last week when we look at the Third Age, at the forging of the Rings of Power by Celebrimbor, Feanor's grandson, and the rest of his Ringmaker people. But I think that, that's a little bit different, though again, even that seems to be sort of distinctly different from what the dwarves do. That is, we don't see the dwarves. You think of the stuff that the elves have made, the Rings of Power, the Palantiri, the Silmarils, even just these gems that Finrod has brought, and you compare that with the Nauglafring. Again, this is the highest, this is the greatest, this is the most amazing thing the dwarves have ever made. And it's a setting for the elven gems. And in the end, it's going to be perfected when a Silmaril is going to be set in it later on. Now, you know, I don't merely want to slight dwarven craft, but this is why it's sort of, as I said, it's sort of seeming to me different. Dave, welcome. You want to add something here?
Mostly, I figured that the listeners didn't know what to do with themselves and they hadn't heard from me for like 45 minutes. I do think there appears to be some sort of qualitative difference between the sort of kinds of Brandon. I think it's Brandon uses the word technology in the text. I think that's a very interesting suggestion. There seems to be something very different about, particularly like when you compare the sort of technology of the dwarves to, say, the technology of the elves, particularly the Silmarils and later on the rings and such.
There is a difference, I think. I agree that the Rings of Power are definitely seem a little bit more technological. Though again, I mean, if you take sort of there's the Rings of Power and the Palantiri. I mean, I'm not comparing what their functions are and what they do. Obviously, they do very different things. But I mean, if you think of dwarven craftsmanship, the only other thing I can think of, which is I'm really hesitating to use this word because I think it's a really inappropriate word. And that is, I want to say that the elves are more creative or more original than the dwarves. That is, instead of just making beautiful things or like doing something that lots of people do, but doing it really well, like the dwarves do, the elves are being, well, at least they're being more sub-creative, it seems. Gems, nobody ever thought of gems before. What have the dwarves thought of that nobody thought of? I mean, the only thing that I can think of is mithril, basically. And mithril isn't like a secret alloy that the dwarves make. They mine it. I mean, it's a special metal that they find and do cool things with. But even what they do with it is pretty normal. Like, sure, like a suit of mithril armor is pretty awesome. But its awesomeness is in the mithril itself, which, again, was just mined by the dwarves. The mithril from the dwarves is not like the Silmarils from Feanor.
Well, you just alienated all of your pro-dwarf listeners.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm
I was going to say, do you think there's a is there a subtle difference between creation and sub-creation, sub-creative practices and arts, and craftsmanship and technology? I mean, from one sense, those things are really all in the same. In one sense, those things are really quite similar, but maybe they're subtly different. I think the dwarves might say, yeah, sure, you know, like the awesomeness of a mithril coat is in the mithril, but we're the ones that figured out that you could make it into a coat that you could wear around and
yeah.
It would keep orc spirits from running you through and arrows from sticking in your chest and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, sure. Yes. Yes, that's true. I think there is a difference, but I'm not sure that I'm really going to point to it well. I should explain, by the way, the reason I'm hesitant to use the word creative or original is that those words, well, those are very modern ideas, at least as connected with art. That is the idea that a work of art or a work of craft, whatever it be, whether it be a work of literary craft or painting, or whether it be of the craft of hands or whatever, that it should be original, that it should be new, that it should be creative, that it should be unlike anything anybody has done before. That's a very modern obsession. And it was not something that concerned people for a really long time. That is the passion to do something new, to break totally new ground. That's why I was hesitating to use the word either original or creative, because it sort of seems that, like, I don't want it to sound like I'm just saying, like, the dwarves are so boring. I mean, they're just so like swords, mail, like, you know, that is so last week. Like, we have been doing swords and mail. And, like, sure, you're doing really nice swords and mail. And, oh, jewelry now. What a clever idea. Lots of people have been doing jewelry. I don't think that slighting things on that ground is sensible. And I don't think it's really appropriate. Because I don't see that as any kind of a sort of a core value of art in Tolkien's world, art or craft. Or both, but I do think that there's a sense in which I go back to the gems of the Noldor and the remark that even Aule hadn't thought of these. You know, that they are bringing forth a new thing. That this is a piece of subcreation. That just as under Iluvatar, the Valar in their song, in their improvisational parts in their song, brought about out of their own minds, which are of course derived from the mind of Iluvatar, out of their own minds they brought forth these themes of music, and they adorned them, and they contributed to this. So that when they come down here and when the Valar are working and they're making the world happen, you know, they're making their own contributions out of their own, you know, out of the artistic gifts that Iluvatar has given them. And basically, the elves do that too. And with the Noldor, we can see they're making a contribution. They're making a contribution under the Valar, but that even the Valar themselves didn't think of. My question, I guess, then is, do the dwarves do that? And I can't think of any examples.
It seems like there's a subtle difference. I'm gonna make a half-hearted, superficial stab at it that to give you a chance to shoot it down. But could it be related in some way to practical utility? In other words, the dwarves tend to make things for some sort of earthly purpose. They make coats to wear and hammers to hammer with. And I guess the Nauglamir maybe doesn't have tremendous practical purpose. Whereas the impulse for Fëanor to create the Silmaril seemed to be he didn't make them thinking, well, this will be excellent backup storage for the light, or I want to make them so that I can light lit rooms, or even so that they'll, I think he just made them to make them.
Yeah.
Shoot it down.
Yeah. No, I mean,
it's not simply utility. That's really
right.
Reductionist and terrible.
Right.
The dwarves
right.
make useful things. The elves make useless things.
Right. Right. And of course, even like, you know, beautiful and useless versus just beautiful doesn't exactly work either.
No.
Yeah. But I think that one thing which Brandon, I think, has brought up in the text, and which Chris kind of points to also over here, the dwarves appreciate beauty within their own sphere, Chris says. And I think that's really true. And what Brandon brought up as well was the Guttering Caves of Aglarond and Gimli's response there. And that, without question, Gimli's speech to Legolas about how awesome the caves under Helm's Deep are is, without question, the most unadulterated piece of dwarven aesthetics that we get anywhere. I mean, this is the one moment where we hear the dwarfs really sort of expressing their own aesthetic values. And we can see the passion of Gimli for the beauty of the part of the natural world that the dwarves are really a part of. And again, I think back to the Aule and Yavanna chapter, and the her reference to him at the end that, you know, your children will have little love for the things of my love, right? True, but of course the corollary to that is they're going to have great love for the things of Aule's love, meaning the things of the earth and the things and the caves and the mountains, even from Gimli's first comment upon their arrival at Helm's Deep that this country has tough bones. He can feel them in his feet as he came up. And then, of course, his raptures at the Guttering Caves. So clearly they do appreciate beautiful things for the sake of beauty. And when Legolas responds to Gimli with making basically assumptions that dwarves are going to be thinking only pragmatically, it's like, oh, the dwarves would mine that place. It's good that the dwarves don't know about it, because they would wreck it, you know, by mining it. And Gimli says, you don't understand. We would never do that. No dwarf would do that. So that we can see that it really is more than just utility. It's more than just for use. They do have a pure aesthetic angle to their craftsmanship. And so perhaps, you know, Gimli's establishment of his realm in the Guttering Caves, perhaps that's I mean, it seems a little bit funny to compare that to the Silmarils or to the Rings of Power or something, but maybe in a sense that is a kind of parallel.
Laura, they're more alike than they care to admit.
Yeah. Laura, you've been wanting to say something for a while.
I was just thinking about Gimli and Galadriel, actually. The gift that Galadriel gives Gimli is a lock of her hair. And Gimli takes it and looks at it and thinks, how can I set this? You know, what can I put it in? What kind of crystal? And he's obviously not making anything useful out of it. And yet he sort of wants to improve on the natural beauty a little bit. So maybe that's more of the dwarvish character. You know, they appreciate beauty, but they always want to sort of improve on that. But, you know, we were talking about, do elves make useful things? Well, all of Galadriel's gifts, the seed to Sam and the file to Frodo, those are all very useful things. I mean, they're beautiful, but they're also useful. So, but they seem to be a little more natural and a little more less crafted, I guess you would call it. So, I don't know. It's kind of a subtle difference there, but maybe that speaks to the difference in mind between the dwarves and the elves.
Now, I think that's very cool. I'm really glad that you brought up Galadriel and especially Gimli's response to the gift, because I think we can see two things there. Of course, on the one hand, we get two really direct Silmaril echoes in the Galadriel's gift exchanges. One is her gift to Frodo. The file of Galadriel is very Silmaril-like. You've got he gets this crystal bottle that has the light from Eärendil's star in it, which of course is the light of the Silmaril. So, what she gives Frodo is like the Silmaril at one remove, right? The light of the trees in the Silmaril contained in the file. So we already see this one fairly explicitly Silmaril-esque gift. But as you pointed out, Laura, Gimli's response, when Gimli asks for a strand of her hair, of Galadriel's hair, and she says, what will you do with it? And he says, I will preserve it in imperishable crystal. Right? So that's his Silmarils. Again, and he gets three of them. Right? So he gets three strands of hair, which he's going to put in crystal. So those are going to be the dwarfish Silmarils. Right? And instead of the light of the trees, you have, you have Goadriel's hair, the strands of Goadriel's hair in the crystal. And the thing is that this is not an accidental connection at all. In fact, in one of his later essays, Tolkien talks about this, and he expands upon some of the Silmarillion things, and he actually said that the significance of this moment, you'll remember in the Fellowship of the Ring that the people kind of gasp, and Celeborn looks at Gimli and is like shocked that Gimli would ask this. It's the dwarves all seem to the elves all seem to react like Gimli has said something really shocking by asking for a strand of her hair, and the thing that Tolkien said earlier on was that actually that Galadriel's hair is gold and is gold mixed with silver. It has both gold and silver in it, and that Fëanor, in seeing Galadriel's hair, got the idea of the Silmarils from her hair. Like, look, it is the light, that her hair was like the light of both trees mingled together. And that, in thinking about Galadriel's hair, he was like, Silmarils, how would I take the light? And I put the light of both trees in crystal, and that Fëanor asked for Galadriel's hair, can I have a few strands of your hair to work with? And Galadriel says no. And turns him down. And so then here's this dwarf asking for what she refused to Fëanor himself, and she says yes. I think that that's, so yes, of course, that Galadriel's hair in imperishable crystal, especially if it's really imperishable, there you go, the dwarven Silmarils. Now even there, I think that we can see a kind of difference between, we can see a kind of difference between the dwarven Silmarils and the elven Silmarils, the original ones. That again, I still think that Gimli's are for remembrance in ways in which, Fëanor were not. I mean, we think back to the discussion we had about Fëanor and the Silmarils and his pride and how, he became sort of obsessed with his own creations. Whereas he was not just saying, hey, I want to preserve the light to remember it because I'm just focusing on the light. We're told that he forgets that the light within them is not his own, right? Whereas Gimli is never thinking of himself and always thinking of Galadriel when he's looking at his stuff.
Chris, you had a really good point that you just typed in all caps that I'd like to let you make sort of a final response to the dwarf and elf thing.
Well, I almost feel my moment has passed, but I guess we've talked about this before, that the Silmarillion, these works were written by elves, and so they don't really understand where the dwarves are coming from. So we talked about Gimli's reaction to the caves. It was such a revelation to Legolas that, we had no idea that dwarves had this kind of aesthetic appreciation. I guess that was one of the points. The other thing I thought that strikes me is that the dwarves, how to say it, they almost, like Aula, they just love the creative process or the craft. I think we talked about crafting. They like the doing almost more than the end product, it seems to me. I mean, that just kind of occurred to me. I don't know if I'm right on target there, but that's how it kind of strikes me. So it's a little different emphasis than the elves, where they make these great things, but the dwarves just love to be making all the time.
Yeah, I get that's really interesting. That the possibility of that distinction, that is the distinction between the delight in the thing made and the delight in the making. Maybe. I'm not sure, but I think that's possible.
Just a thought.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Mike, go ahead.
I really like that point about the dwarves, delighting in the things themselves and the making of things. And I was thinking sort of on a spectrum, if you go on beyond dwarves, then you start talking about something like dragons, where they, they're just hoarding things for their own sake, and they can never use any of it in any way. So it's sort of like further down the spectrum in terms of how these different races, I guess if you're going to call dragons a race, interact with objects and possess things and either use them or don't use them.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, if you want to think about the difference between the delight in the thing made and the delight in the making, The dragons are clearly like on the opposite end of the spectrum from dwarves in that sense, right? Though, of course, I mean, we do see some similarity. I mean, I don't think it's quite fair in the end to say that dwarves really only delight in the making. We do see them, of course, you know, back to Thorin Oakenshield, you know, and his falling under the dragon sickness and his obsession with the gold. But you know, even there, that was corruption. I mean, he was being corrupted in that way. And you know, I mean, that's certainly not showing Thorin at his essential or at his best. But the dragons certainly, and we'll see a little bit more of them later, though we don't get really the full relationship between dragons and treasure kind of treatment here in Silmarillion. And we will see Glaurung sitting on a big pile of treasure later on, but we won't get that full. That's not going to be the primary thing that we're going to get with Glaurung, his relationship with treasure, I mean. Anyway, it's certainly worth thinking about. Let's talk about Manwë and Ulmo. Jack, you wanted to talk about Manwë giving aid to the elves?
Yeah. So in this chapter, we have a couple of interventions by the Valar. In particular, when Fingon is rescuing Maedhros, he sends up a prayer to Manwë saying, or whatever, and Manwë answers and sends the eagle, etc., to help out. As soon as that happened, I was scratching my head because I was thinking back to the Doom of Mandos. And if I could just read that line, it, you know, it didn't happen too long ago. Tears unnumbered ye shall shed, and the Valar will fence Valinor against you and shut you out so that not even the echo of your lamentation shall pass over the mountains. And so here we have Manwë, like it seems like 2 weeks later, coming to the rescue of not just any elf, but the son of Feanor. So, you know, what's going on here? Is Manwë throwing Mandos under the bus here? Does it weaken the curse?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, I think. I mean, for me, one of the main things that I always take from that moment, that is Manwë's intervention with Fingon and Maedhros. By the way, side note, this chapter begins to highlight probably the most significant pronunciation error that Martin Shaw makes in the unabridged audio recording. He continually calls Feanor's eldest son Maedhros. It should be Maedhros, A-E in Elvish is pronounced, it's pronounced I, not A. So Maedhros and the nephew of Turgon, who's going to get his own chapter in a couple of weeks, is Maeglin, not Maeglin. But anyway, it's one of the persistent errors that Martin Shaw makes in that recording, and one of the primary reasons that I like his recording much less than Robert Inglis's recording of The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. Anyway, sorry. End side note. Manwë's, the primary thing that I get one of the primary points I would make based on Manwë's intervention with Fingon and Maedhros there is simply that if we are tempted to think now or later that the Valar really just aren't paying attention, you know, that the Valar are not, you know, they've totally separated themselves. They're just leaving Middle-earth to itself. They're not looking, they're not caring, and Ulmo is like going around behind the backs of everybody else, and he's like the rogue Valar who still cares about Middle-earth. It's tempting to see it that way at times, but I don't think that that's actually the case. And this is the plainest example of that. I mean, we're not just saying like, and someone prays to Manwë, and then like eventually the thing that they prayed for comes to pass, showing that Manwë was probably paying attention. I mean, this is completely instantaneous. A dramatic, direct, and instantaneous response. Manwë is obviously paying a lot of attention to what's going on here. And he receives messages. We've heard about, you know, and thought a little bit about Ulmo being brought messages from all of the streams and the waters of Middle-earth. But Manwë gets messages too, from the birds and, of course, from his sight, with which he can see, from Tiniquetil, the mountain, one of the other words that Martin Shaw mispronounces. Anyway, so I think that that's, at the very least, I think there's more that we can get from it than that. And so, I mean, Jack, going on to sort of your more significant question, is he undermining the curse? I don't think so, exactly. Well, I mean, I guess in a sense you could say that. I mean, if what Manwe's sort of job here was, or if what his goal was to basically increase the suffering of the Noldor, like, I'm gonna set myself to making you people as miserable as possible, and I'm going to visit your crimes upon your head at every opportunity. Well, obviously there were worse things that could, I mean, think of what was just about to happen. What was just about to happen? Fingon was just drawing his bow to shoot his close friend dead. Which is, sounds like exactly what the Curse of Mandos is dooming them to. You know, that friend shall die at the hand of friend, and one of you is going to betray the other. And so it seems like, yeah. Now, it's not that, of course, obviously Fingon isn't betraying Maedhros here in shooting him, but this is an act of friendship and kindness and not an act of betrayal. But again, the pattern would seem to be like, yep, Curse of Mandos at work again, one elf slaying another, but... Of course, this is the moment, this is the biggest moment of one of the Noldor trying to go against the curse, trying to undo the momentum of the curse, in a sense. And Fingon succeeds in doing that. This is Fingon's greatest moment. This is the thing that Fingon really achieves, and that is reconciling the Sons of Feanor and the Sons of Fingolfin and Finarfin. And I think that... You can see Manwë, the two other things that we can see from Manwë here, I think, is one, basically his endorsement of that. The Curse of Mandos does not necessarily reflect, this is what I want to happen. I'm hoping to see as much treachery, betrayal, and friend killing friend as possible. You know, if that were the case, then, yeah, I mean, he would have sit back chuckling at this moment as Fingon is drawing his bow. So obviously, that's not what he's really, I was about to say shooting for. That would be inappropriate. That's not what he's looking for. And I think it also certainly does kind of qualify his relationship with the curse. In other words, the Curse of Mandos, this is not just the Valar saying, you've been bad, and so we're going to punish you very badly. But rather, you know, basically, the Valar saying to the Noldor, you have rebelled. You have done wickedness. And we are here to tell you that, you know, not exactly what goes around comes around, not like in a karmic sense, but basically you are going to reap the fruit of your own actions. And by and large, we're going to let that happen. You wanted to leave? You'll be able to leave. They're exiled? Yeah, they left of their own accord. And as a result, they're exiled. They're going to be facing betrayal. Friend is going to kill friend. Well, yeah, because they don't trust each other anymore because of the kinslaying. Is now, you know, now that the whole kinslaying concept is on the table, and then the betrayal, with the ships at Hloskar, they're not going to trust each other anymore. So the curse is in a large part, it seems, at least in its initial conception, a self-perpetuating thing. That is, it is the fruit of their own actions. Manwë is not, okay, it's not something that he inflicts on them. I'm going to make you do bad things or receive bad things. And here we can see what seems to be an affirmation, and one of the only times this is going to happen. Manwë is not going to do much interceding in the rest of the history of Beleriand, but he does here. And where he does is at this moment, where Fingon is taking the big step to go in the opposite direction of the Curse of Feanor. And the results of his action are not doomed to failure. The results of his action are a success, and they bring about reconciliation and reuniting. And that's good, and Manwë seems to approve of that. And I mean, I think that's a really crucial moment. Anybody else have anything they wanted to say about Fingon and Maedhros? This being one of those, you know, 10 or 15 enormously important stories that get thrown out in this chapter here. Yeah. Dave, go ahead.
Sure. I just think it's particularly interesting that the way they find each other is through song.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, that's...
I don't have too much more to to add about that. I just think that's really, really interesting and cool, and there must be more to it than that that I haven't worked out yet. But it's very cool, and particularly a song about Valinor, right?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the important thing that I was going to point to. That is, it's not just that they're saying this is on page 110. In the Houghton Mifflin trade paperback that I use. Then in defiance of the orcs, end of the top paragraph. Then in defiance of the orcs, who cowered still in the dark vaults beneath the earth, he took his harp and sang a song of Valinor that the Noldor made of old, before strife was born among the sons of Finwë. And his voice rang in the mournful hollows that had never heard before aught save cries of fear and woe. Thus Fingon found what he sought, for suddenly above him, far and faint, his song was taken up, and a voice answering called to him. Here's a cool thing about the singing. What do we associate song with so far? Well, subcreation, right? I mean, we certainly, even though we're already on, even though we're all the way up to page 100 by now, we should still remember, of course, the music of the Ainur, especially since we have the reference to the Noldor having made this song. And what is it of? The song is a song of Valinor in peace. Valinor in unity, Valinor in communion, in community. And what happens? Mithros joins with him in singing. And what happens as a result? Community, union. That is, they do make what they sing through their song. That it's not just that the song is the means to do this, but that, in a sense, and it's, you know, you could say it's a kind of an accidental sense, but I don't think so. Their song does make the thing that they sing, which is a kind of return to Valinorian, pre-Feanorian peace, and unity, and, or at least pre-bad Feanorian, peace. Yes, I mean, I think that's a pretty cool thing. Their song there, I think, is definitely important, especially when contrasted with the cries of fear and woe, which is all you ever usually hear in those parts. That's sort of serves further to emphasize the unity and peace and beauty. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, for anyone who's read Lord of the Rings, this should immediately make us think of Frodo and Sam in the Tower of Cirith Ungol.
Absolutely.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yep, absolutely. And that's the thing. the thing that I just said about the sort of them sort of making or subcreating peace and harmony through their song here never occurred to me before, because I usually think forward instead of back at this moment. Forward to Beren and Lúthien, and forward to Frodo and Sam, like I talked about in my Kalamazoo talk on typology, which I posted last summer. That's my normal train of thought when I'm in this passage. But I do think that we should also be looking backwards, back to the music of the Ainur, and thinking about sort of music as we have seen music be used so far. So I think that's pretty cool. Laura, you had wanted to say something too?
Well, I was going to mention the music, but also, I just wanted to say, it's just heartbreaking that this scene is not more played out. It, you know, you get a couple of paragraphs. It's almost, you could almost miss it if you weren't doing a very close reading. You know, just like the death of Feanor, it seems almost anticlimactic. It's like, okay, is that it? You know, you could miss it if you blinked, basically.
Yeah. No, the capture of Mithros and then the rescue of Mithros by Fingon, it just begs for epic poetry, doesn't it? I mean, this would be a fantastic episode in an epic poem.
I think they should figure out a way to get the scene in the Hobbit movie coming up.
That would be good. But, you know, it's funny. I've had a couple people recently ask me, like, well, you know, do you think after they're done with the Hobbit movie, they're going to do a Silmarillion movie? To which my answer is, no, I don't think they will do that. At least not while Christopher Tolkien lives. But there's certainly, and I can't say there aren't moments that wouldn't work really well though. And this is certainly one that I do think would. But Brandon?
I was going to say about music, it's like, I remember one of the lectures you were talking about, it's funny that, you know, someone who's about to go into battle sings, you know, brings out his deadly weapon, the harp. you know? Yes. But, you know, you hear a lot in this chapter about music, about trumpets playing and the power and the sound of and, like, how music, and then later on, I don't want to spoil alert, but, you know, Luthien and her song and the power of the song. Okay, you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're a musician, so, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is really, I'm here to, you know, to give a shout out to Jordan's favorite guy in the comment that Jordan made in the text earlier on about it, it's sort of seeming like Fingolfin actually makes the sun rise, you know, when his trumpets sound. You know, I mean, from what we're told in the previous chapters, it does not in fact seem like Fingolfin caused the rising of the sun. However, he does, as Brandon just pointed out in the text, flowers do spring up at his feet. Now, again, that's because the sun rose, and we know that the flowers are responding to the sun. However, it seems like not a coincidence. Remember the effect of the sun rising on Morgoth and every all of his people. And so there's at least this coincidental conjunction of Fingolfin's army, which has made it through the Helcaraxa, and, you know, they've accomplished this amazing feat, one of the big amazing feats, the crossing of the Helcaraxa, and they are coming down, and then at their trumpets, the sun rises, the flowers spring up, and Morgoth cowers in fear and hides under, you know, deep underground, under his fortress. So that's, it's not actually caused by Fingolfin, but at the same time, I don't think it's entirely an accident either. And I think that that's really pretty powerful. Jordan, go ahead.
Well, I think I agree. It's really powerful, and I actually just kind of wanted to read that part because I love it so much. But as the host of Fingolfin marched into Mithrim, the sun rose flaming in the west, and Fingolfin unfurled his blue and silver banners and blew his horns, and flowers sprang beneath his marching feet, and the ages of the stars were ended. At the uprising of the great light, the servants of Morgoth fled into Angband, and Fingolfin passed unopposed through the fastness of Dor Daedaloth, while his foes hid beneath the earth. Then the elves smote upon the gates of Angband, and the challenge of their trumpets shook the towers of Thangorodrim, and Maedros heard them at his torrent cried aloud, but his voice was lost in the echo of the stone. I always have loved that part and thought, like, how awesome, like, what a better way to, like, bring your army into the earth than the sun rising behind you, trumpets playing, banners unfurling, and flowers springing at your feet, and the enemy fleeing from you in terror. It's almost like Fingolfin is the best character in the book.
It's almost like that, Jordan. You're right. No, and of course, that I would draw attention to, thinking back to where we started, think of the contrast between Fingolfin's approach to Angband and Feanor's approach to Angband, right? Feanor comes as in his own eyes anyway, the conquering hero, the single-handed conquering hero. He didn't need Fingolfin, so he leaves them behind. He doesn't need his own armies. He's left his own armies behind, and he's going single-handedly to beat Morgoth up, right? And he sees it from a distance, and he knows that he can't take it, but he doesn't care, and he's still going to spit out his curses at Morgoth as he dies, and tell his sons to keep doing the impossible thing, trying to do the impossible thing. Fingolfin, with his whole army, you know, in unity, marches straight up to the gates of Angband, but he sees, yeah, there's no point in this, and immediately turns away and goes and, like, looks after his people and does the prudent thing. It's not like he has a moment of repentance like Feanor, because he doesn't need to repent for nearly so much as Feanor does. But certainly he reacts with wisdom. But yeah, the image of Feanor's mad fey solo rush towards Angband contrasted with the, you know, sort of the steady and triumphant march of Fingolfin right up to the gates of Angband there, I think really just a perfect little sort of character contrast between the two of them. Brandon, go ahead. I think you would wanted to add something about the music when we started talking about Fingolfin here.
No, didn't I already say that I think that just music is a really great chapter, and it seems like it's funny that someone going to battle would bring out a harp, but yet there is power in music. And you see this throughout the entire, I mean, the world was created, the universe is created through music. I mean, I wonder what kind of music it is, but it's just, it's interesting to kind of include music that is so powerful to shatter, you know, whole armies and, you know, so on, and be heard for quite some time. And I also wanted to touch on how, in a moment, I think it is, maybe it's Finrod and Fingolfin who cries out to Manwë, and Finrod maybe, and Manwë sends the East. They pretty much assume it's a U catastrophe. So would you say that's a U catastrophic moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially because there's an eagle involved. So that pretty much by definition makes that U catastrophic. And I think what we see there also is a foretaste of the big U catastrophe that's coming. Of course, the first age is going to end with the big old U catastrophe, the biggest U catastrophe in history. In a sense, even bigger than, I mean, it's a very different kind of U catastrophe than we get at the end of the Lord of the Rings, at the end of the third age. But, the one at the end of the first age, you have to admit, is even more spectacular than the U catastrophe at the end of the third age. We'll more on when we get to it. But anyway, what we have here is a foretaste of that. And, I mentioned just now and, talked in the recording I made last summer, at my Kalamazoo talk about the ways that this passage anticipates Beren and Lúthien and it anticipates Frodo and Sam. So we get these foretastes, but in a deeper sense, though you don't have the exact parallels that we get with those other scenes here, it most directly anticipates, Eärendil, and the final U catastrophe. Eärendil is going to do like the big Fingon impression. That is, he's going to make the self-sacrificial journey for the sake of union and the sake of mercy. And he is going to be making sort of he's going to be making the big, petition and intercession on the part of everybody. And I think, you know, what Fingon does is a picture of that to come. And we saw Manwë respond the first time, and we'll see Manwë respond the second time. so yes, it's a little U catastrophe, that saves Maedhros, and is anticipating the big U catastrophe, that's gonna happen later. Now, as usual, I don't want to say too much about that yet, because we haven't gotten there yet, and it'll be much more powerful when we do actually get to Eärendil, but let's make sure that when we get to Eärendil, we remember Fingon and come back to this, because I think that's pretty cool. Good. Let's see. Other things? I mean, goodness, there are still so many things we haven't touched on. We haven't talked much about Gondolin and Nargothrond, but that's okay. I actually don't mind saving that, because of course we're gonna have a lot more to say, about Gondolin and Nargothrond. In fact, we might as well save that for next week, when we look at Of Beleriand and its realms, which is possibly the most notorious chapter for first-time readers of the Silmarillion. The first-time readers of the Silmarillion who make it through the Valaquenta usually hit the wall in next chapter. As Matt says, the geography chapter. So why don't we save the Ulmo discussion, the dreams from Ulmo discussion, for there, because we'll be talking about Nargothrond and Gondolin a little bit more next time. So let's save that. Anything else that people would like to cover? Laura, go ahead. You had a Fingolfin point that you'd wanted to make. Go ahead.
Yeah, Fingolfin shows a little bit of pride here towards the end of the chapter, where he boasts that, "Saved by treason among themselves, Morgoth could never again burst from the leaguer of the Eldar, nor come upon them at unawares." So that's a little bit of a boast and a little bit of a foretelling, I guess, of something that might happen. But I mean, why tempt fate? Why even say something like that?
Yeah, I still think one thing that you can still say, when Fingolfin boasts out of pride, it's still so different from Feanor boasting out of pride, right? What does Feanor get proud of? Well, himself and the stuff that he makes. What does Fingolfin get proud of? His people, right? The whole group, their community. The collective, he is convinced that they, the Noldor, all working together, that the way that they are all, there's no way that Morgoth could ever overcome them. And now, on the one hand, he has some justification for this confidence in that there have now been three battles, two main battles and one lesser battle. And it's just, and they've not even been close. The elves are just stomping on the orcs. There's not even any competition. So, he's certainly, go ahead.
Do you think he thinks that there might be some strife among the elves and that's going to bring him down? Do you think he has some knowledge of that, or do you think he doesn't think that's possible, so that Morgoth really isn't going to be able to do anything?
Well, again, it's easy to see how you can think, look, the day is not going to come when these orcs are going to be able to defeat us in battle. You can see how that would make a certain amount of sense, but certainly the one way in which Fingolfin is getting just a little bit Feanorian here is that he is underrating Morgoth and overrating, again, not himself personally in the way that Fëanor would, but all of them collectively. You think of the towering arrogance of Fëanor sprinting after the orcs, hoping to catch Morgoth, even if he did catch Morgoth in an open camp. What's his plan? Like, I'm gonna single-handedly take out a Valar? I don't think so. We remember the moment at Forminos when he slams the door of his house in the face of the mightiest creature in Arda. Fingolfin too here seems to be forgetting that, they're not just dealing, there's more than orcs here. They're not just dealing with, It is no brigand or orc chieftain that they are dealing with here. He's got some more things going on. Now, of course, those of you who are familiar with what's going to happen in the next five chapters or so can see the ominous foreboding and foreshadowing in my comments to challenging Morgoth to combat and what a crazy idea that would be. But we'll get to that more too when we get there. Dave, go ahead.
Well, I would just toss in, so you pointed it out that the significant difference between him and Fëanor is the fact that he's proud of not himself specifically, but his people, the Noldor. But, the thing I would toss out there is Noldor, the guys who are in exile, who were cursed by Mandos on their way out, and specifically who were told that not only are you guys cursed, but you're cursed to suffering from a chronic problem of treason and backstabbing and your plans falling apart and stuff. And what does this guy say? He sits there and says, there's really nothing bad could happen to us. We couldn't possibly lose except through treason. You think as he said that, he would have remembered Mandos' parting words as he's on his way. There's really, there's nothing that could beat us except treason. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait. So, it's like, oh, yeah. But, and what are the odds of that? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've only murdered a bunch of our own elves already. we've only been abandoned by Fëanor already. You'd think that maybe he would have been. Seems like a really kind of dumb thing to say.
Well,
I think
you might
have been caught up in the moment.
Sort of.
Or I wonder, the one thing I wonder, though, is it, perhaps we're to understand this as a little bit of a prophecy, almost?
Well, but see, the thing is that, certainly there are things that it could be seen to be prophetic of, but not really. When the leaguer of Angband is broken, that is, so this is what has been set up. This is the longest period of peace. We're told that the land is never wholly at peace, but still, this is going to be the longest period of peace. This is the time it's like the Bliss of Valinor, right, for Beleriand. When they have Morgoth, they think, penned up. there are going to be two major battles after this, which are going to go very badly. The Dagor Bragalach, the Battle of Sudden Flame, which is the one that's going to happen next, and then the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. The Battle of Unnumbered Tears, that's going to go bad because of treachery. The Dagor Bragalach is not. That is going to be Fingolfin's boast, well, not coming back to bite him, but being disproven. What is going to end up breaking this peace that Fingolfin is here so proud of is, in fact, simple, raw power of Morgoth. That there's going to come a time, it's going to be in a few hundred years, but there's going to come a time when Morgoth is basically going to, you know, the fine day is going to come when Morgoth says, you really think you can hold back one of the Valar? Try this, blam! And, you know, and he's going to, it's going to be a pretty momentous blam when it comes. So, so in other words, it's not going to be treachery that's going to break the Leaguer. It's going to be Morgoth just pounding the stuffing out of him in the Battle of Sudden Flame. Now that's not the final turning point, though it will be for Fingolfin himself. So again, more on this when we actually see that happen. Mike, you wanted to add something to this?
I was actually going to ask a question about something unrelated back to Fingolfin and the trumpets. I don't know if we want to go back there though.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm also a trumpet player, and I'm kind of obsessed with color in the books. And Fingolfin is associated with the colors blue and with the silver trumpets. And in the Lord of the Rings movie, I don't know if it's an actual line from the book, but at least in the movie, there's a line where Boromir says, have you ever been called home by the sound of silver trumpets? And if it's not in the book, yeah, maybe it should have been in the book. Because I think that's a nice echo back to the silver trumpets have an especially pure and good association in both of the books.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's not in the books, but I agree. That scene, that is that exchange between Boromir and Aragorn, is definitely, it's one of my favorite added bits that isn't in the book. I like that a lot. The silver of his trumpets, and of course the parallels that is explicitly establishing between him and Telperion, the Tree of Silver, and therefore also the rising of the moon, which rises, we're told, right as they leave the Helcaraxes. So you've got, as soon as they step foot on Middle-earth, on the shores of Beleriand, the moon rises, and as soon as they march into Mithrim, the sun rises. And they blow their silver trumpets. I do think the silver trumpets are pretty cool in that way. Let's see, Brandon, you had one other thing there?
I remember C.S. Lewis, or maybe it was Tolkien in his letters, talking about how the importance of saying argent. I mean, maybe I don't know if we had style time yet, but we could go into style time. Why use
argent? Hey, we didn't do style time.
Silver, and Tolkien says something about, or C.S. Lewis says something about. Yeah. So I mean, you know, and I also wanted to know about what's up with host? Why are they saying the host of Morgoth or the host of Fëanor's host? How is host being used? So let's do some sort of style time, and maybe you can just comment on that.
Yeah, no, great. Of the two, host is the host is fairly simple in that's sort of, you know, the archaic word just for army, basically, is the way in which that's being used. What I am doing right now is I am trying to come up with a theory on argent versus silver, which I haven't thought of. Well, rather, I have a theory and I'm testing it. Let's see. What I'm doing right now is looking up both words in the OED. That's what I thought. Okay, I have an answer for your silver versus argent question. Argent is from French, ultimately back to Latin. Silver is an Anglo-Saxon word. There you go. So that's why I think Tolkien would prefer silver to argent, in fact. Now, I don't think that it's therefore necessarily true that, by the way, shout out to the OED. If you have any access to the Oxford English Dictionary, it is by like a factor of 100 the best dictionary to use. No other dictionary possibly compares to it in its etymological usefulness and its, you know, the etymologies that it gives and the historical record of how the word has been used in various ways in various times. Absolutely unbelievable. But anyway, so silver might seem sort of simple. It might even possibly seem more modern. Argent seems like the more archaic word. But actually it is, argent is a much more recent word, because it's a French word. Silver is the old word, in English anyway. It's the old, it's from a common, there are words that are analogs of silver, silver, in Anglo-Saxon, silver. There are analogs in all of the Germanic languages. I mean, it seems to have been an old Germanic word. So that's by far of the two of them, the more ancient word. And so therefore, I think probably that alone would explain why he would, be inclined towards that. Anyway, so that's my answer about silver. And I think it's actually something which sort of expand, you know, in the style time mode, kind of expanding on that a little bit. The thing that one is tempted to say about the style of the Silmarillion and the word choice of the Silmarillion is that, you know, it's very archaic. It's very, sort of formulaic. And so there's a temptation, I think, for us to sort of see or expect these kind of bigger words, and fancier sounding words. But what he's not doing is making it, he's not going out of his way to make it sound ornate. He is making it archaic, but of course, as in a case like this, making it sound archaic, making it be, in fact, more archaic, to have greater antiquity, is sometimes to use much simpler words, quite common words, because of course many of our very common words are Anglo-Saxon words. And in the Silmarillion, he always really wanted to use old words. Anyway, good. Well, we should probably wrap up. The two major things that we haven't talked about that I think of off the top of my head are, as I already mentioned, the Gondolin and Nargothrond thing. Also, the political relations between the Noldor and, the Sindar with, Thingol. But that, too, I think we could save for the geography chapter. That might be a good way to talk about, and to incorporate that discussion into some of the things that we see, in the next chapter. Okay, so unless anyone has any last final things, I think we're pretty much done for tonight.
This is Matt Shaw, and that is it for this time. Join us for our next episode, in which we discuss that perennial crowd pleaser of Beleriand and its realms. Farewell, and remember, if more of us valued food and cheer above hoarded gold, it would be a much merrier world.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.